And it's a good afternoon again, Lagos. So some of you will say good evening on all of that. My name is Ireti Bakare Yusuf. Welcome to Borderlines, the only show that takes you beyond borders to places where other radio shows haven't been, haven't dared to step, haven't even bothered to research, nor have they bothered to talk about. As you know, yes, the big news in the world is still Israel's war against Gaza. So I have with me today my first guest. We have two guests, as you know. My first guest, I will fanzine, but I'm going to try and stop myself. Literally, for me, he's one of the heroes since 7/10. And you will get to understand why. He's a straight talker. Yeah, you all look at Norway and you think, oh, they're a little bit gentle, oh, they don't say much. Well, you're about to meet a Norwegian that's a straight talker and he doesn't shy away from saying it. Let me give you an outline of who he is. My guest is Dr. Mads Gilbert. He is a Norwegian medical doctor and professor, senior consultant at Clinic of Emergency Medicine at the University Hospital of Norway. Dr. Mads Gilbert, welcome to Borderlines.
Thank you ever so much, Ireti. It's an honor to be invited and to talk to the great people of Lagos and all your people.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Thank you so much. Right, let me read out the phone numbers, but you know the drill on Borderlines. You send WhatsApp and then we'll see if there's time, we'll pick up calls. And Dr. Gilbert, I'm sure, will be happy to answer you. Studio line 07900-993-993-993. The female-only line, we have a new line for the female line, by the way. 020-146-5791. Again, 020-146-5791. WhatsApp, the all-important WhatsApp, 0809-597-5805. We are streaming live on our website, nigeriainfo.fm. We are on Twitter at nigeriainfo.fm. YouTube is nigeriainfo993. Facebook is nigeriainfo993. And of course, on Instagram, Nigeria Info FM Lagos. Those of you who listen to us across the world and you want to call by Skype, please don't call by Skype. Send a WhatsApp 0809-597-5805. Stop calling. It's not your time yet. Drop the phone. Dr. Gilbert, I'd like to start this with your latest tweet. Is that all right?
Sure.
So you wrote, last update from MOH Gaza, Ministry of Health, that is. MOH spokesperson Dr. Ashraf Al-Qadri, on the 104th day of the brutal Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation committed 15 massacres against families in the Gaza Strip, claiming 172 martyrs and 326 injuries during the past 24 hours. You also wrote, a number of victims are still under the rubble and on the roads, and the ambulance and civil defense crews cannot reach them. The toll of the Israeli aggression has risen to 24,620 martyrs and 61,830 injuries since the 7th of last October. Israeli violations led to the martyrdom of 337 health personnel and the arrest of 99 of them, led by hospital directors in northern Gaza. The Israeli occupation deliberately targeted 150 health institutions, putting 30 hospitals and 53 healthcare centers out of service and targeting 122 ambulances. The Ministry of Health recorded that 8,000 cases of that more than 8,000 cases of vital hepatitis A infection as a result of overcrowding and low levels of personal hygiene in the displacement sites that arrived, followed by government medical teams only. We expect that the number of hepatitis infections will double in the various places of displacements in the Gaza Strip. The Ministry of Health recorded hundreds of cases of miscarriages and premature births as a result of panic and forced escape under brutal bombardment. The lack of health in places of displacements and the difficulty of reaching hospitals puts the lives of 60,000 pregnant women at risk. Pregnancy complications. We warn of the serious repercussions of running out of nitrous gas in operating rooms, which puts the lives of hundreds of wounded and life-saving causes at risk. The Ministry of Health warns of serious health complications affecting 350,000 chronic patients as a result of the lack of availability of medicines and their failure to enter Gaza Strip. Hospital laboratories are unable to conduct laboratory testing, CBC, as a result of the lack of materials for it, as well as the exhaustion of 60% of the materials for various laboratory and viral tests. 10,000 cancer patients are still exposed to serious complications that claim the lives of dozens of patients every day as a result of the lack of medication and lack of health care in places of displacements after the Turkish Friendship Hospital went out of service. The direct and continuous targeting of vicinity of middle area and Khan Yunis hospitals threatens the lives of thousands of wounded, sick, premature and displaced children, and causes the loss of lives of dozens of them as a result of their families being forced to flee with them under bombardments. Massive overcrowding at Tal al-Sutra Maternity Hospital, Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital and the care centers in Rafah, making them unable to handle the large numbers of patients and wounded on a daily basis. I'm almost done. Lagos, you need to hear this. The health and environmental infrastructure in the city of Rafah is very fragile and unable to respond to the needs of more than 1.3 million displaced people and citizens. The Israeli occupation which still controls the volume, quality and cause of medical aid with the aim. You get the idea. You end it with, we call on the International Committee of the Red Cross and the United Nations to work to visit detainees from the health and humanitarian sectors and work to release them. Dr. Gilbert, you've been going to Gaza since 1981. What took you there initially?
Initially, I did not go to Gaza in 81. I went to Beirut, right. West Beirut, 1981. And that was because the Israeli occupation army at that time was going to hunt down the leadership of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which in 81 was, of course, headed by Abu Ammar or Yasser Arafat. And it was a liberation organization in its true word, the meaning of the word, like, you know, the many African liberation organizations you had at that time. So they were waging a political and an armed struggle against the Israeli occupation forces and were, of course, labeled terrorists by the Israeli army and the government. So they invaded Lebanon to go up to West Beirut in order to get rid of the leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. In 81, the summer of 81, they were bombing Fakahani, which was a central part of West Beirut where the PLO had its headquarters. They did not succeed to kill Yasser Arafat, but they called for help. His brother, Fatih Arafat, was the head of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Hilal, and which was at that time the sort of health department. And he called for international support. And we traveled with a small emergency surgical team from Norway to support them. When we came to Beirut, the bombing was over. They had survived. And we stayed for some weeks in a small hospital in a refugee camp in the south of Lebanon, in Al-Bus, close to Rashidiyya. But in 82, the invasion of Beirut took place. The invasion of Lebanon, and with the siege of Beirut, West Beirut, and the relentless bombing of West Beirut through the whole summer of 82. And we went back with new emergency surgical teams from Norway. And as a young anesthesiologist, I had my first graphic experience of the Israeli merciless bombing of civilian targets. They bombed everything in West Beirut, schools, hospitals, ambulances, mosques, water pipelines, sewage systems, everything. And we were standing really virtually wading in blood to try to take care of the wounded. And this experience was a bit of a life changer for me, because I had a more theoretical understanding of colonialism and the brutality of colonial oppression and occupation. So this first encounter with Israeli war machine made me, as a young doctor, decide to be a medical solidarity worker, meaning to take side for the oppressed. I'm not a soldier. I'm unarmed. My weapon is my camera and my stethoscope. But I wanted to be part of the medical solidarity work. And not the NGO industry, which is another thing, you know, the relief industry. So I've been working with the Palestinians since 81, and from around 2005-06, I have been working mostly in Gaza with the Palestinian healthcare. And make no mistake, I work under their leadership. I don't come in on top or on the side or make some sort of "we have our organization." I always report to the Palestinian health authorities and say, "I'm here to support you. Where do you want me to work?"
Why do you think, in fact, before I go through that question, a friend of yours, the head of the emergency services in Al-Shifa Hospital, was brutally murdered. Why is Israel killing health workers, medical workers? Before we even come to the hospitals, why is Israel killing lifesavers, which is effectively, you know, the most important service in wartime, never mind during peacetime, are medical workers? What is this war against doctors about?
Well, I think to have an answer to that question, you should ask the Israeli military and their political leaders, Prime Minister Netanyahu and Minister of Defense Mr. Gallant. They are the ones who really owe the world an answer to that important question. But I'll try. And as you mentioned, so far, the Israeli occupation army has killed 337 healthcare workers, and not only doctors, mind you, nurses, doctors, medical students, pharmacists, nursing students, paramedics, not at least ambulance paramedics, a large array of important medical resources have been systematically targeted and killed. And if you combine that pattern of killing with a pattern of attacks on healthcare systems, you see a pattern of attempts to dismantle the social fabric of the Palestinian society. And I think it's important for all of us to feel that we in our lives, if something happens to us, if we have a car accident or we have cancer or we have malaria, there is somebody there to care for you. So I used to call the hospitals the temples of humanity and compassion in a society. It's like the cornerstone of a society that cares for people. And the hospitals, you can go there around the clock. It's light, it's warm, it's full of caring people with knowledge and skills. And depending on the system, you know, you will get some kind of care. And it is a safe haven for you and your family when there is a problem threatening your health or even threatening your life. Now, if you lose that, you pretty much risk losing hope, because hope is connected to life and life is connected to healthcare. And in an acute phase, like in an earthquake or in a bushfire or in an avalanche of some sort, the healthcare will be expanded both through the disaster plans that we always have in the hospital and the primary healthcare, and by the international response coming to the support of the affected population with anything from tents to blankets to food to medical teams to, you know, dogs that can sniff and find people under the rubble. In the Israeli attack, they do exactly the opposite. They target the civilian population, kill them, maim them. They target the civilian structure, the apartment buildings, the, you know, the whatever place where people are living, and they systematically attack healthcare in order, I think, to discourage the resistance, to make the people of Gaza and the West Bank, they do the same in the West Bank, feel that there may not be any help if you are wounded or if your family or some members of your family are wounded during the attacks, in order to discourage resistance, in order to make people feel helpless, and in order to kill more people, because at the end of the day, the hospitals will be able to care for and to avoid avoidable death in war injuries also, by stopping bleeding, by keeping the airway open, by attending to the wounds, by giving antibiotics and IV fluids and blood, whatever is needed. That's what we're trained to do, to save lives and not to take lives. So I think the Israeli attacks, systematic attacks on healthcare workers and on the hospital and primary healthcare clinics is the antithesis to what we want to stand for, to safeguard life, to protect life, and to protect hope. And this is so systematic, it's so painful to watch. And for all of us who have been working with Palestinian healthcare over the last, like me, 40 years, it's nothing new. They have always been doing this. As I said, in West Beirut in 1982, they attacked the hospitals, they bombed hospitals and ambulances. And when there was a bombing of a house or an apartment building, rescue people would come immediately and start to dig for survivors, and the Israelis would come back and bomb and kill the rescue people, just like they do in Gaza. Look, I have this report from the United Nations. This is called Right to Health. It's from WHO from last year. And it's a very well-written report. And it has a special chapter, which is called Attacks on Health Care. And in the chapter Health Attacks, they report that the Israelis have attacked Palestinian healthcare 563 times during the time period from 2019 to 2021, 2 years. And it's very systematic, it's documented, and you can see the attacks on healthcare people, on ambulances, on clinics, on all the different types of healthcare, and it's divided between the West Bank and Gaza. So this is just one of many reports showing that the Palestinian healthcare is not protected by international law, which forbids the fighting parties to attack healthcare. One of the first objects to be protected by international law was precisely healthcare systems, because they are so important, not only to treat and to save lives, but also for the willingness to live, because you know that you can risk something and still you can be taken care of. So I think the systematic attacks on healthcare and healthcare workers is part of the psychological warfare, the very systematic and sadist attack on people's safety nets and their feeling secure and feeling that somebody will look after you even if you're wounded, or your child or your wife or your husband is wounded. So it's extremely gruesome and it's extremely well known to us, and it has passed with impunity. Tenth of years after tenth of years, Israel have been attacking healthcare. It's documented. It's well described. There is lots of evidence, and they get away with it with this total impunity because they're protected by the United States.
Yes, well, we'll come to the United States later. Given what you've said, and it's that psychological trauma that I want us to talk about a little, we have seen many, many videos of children being amputated without anesthesia. Just horrific, horrific. Doctors having to perform amputation on their own children without any sort of medication. A lot of the doctors have had to default to sort of old-fashioned, rudimental way, you know, medicine. What is it? What do you think gives the Palestinian Gazan doctor? What gives them that motivation, that drive, that determination to keep going? Because when you've had to cut the leg of your child, when you've had to watch, you know, your brethren, your sistering, give birth without anesthesia, without prenatal, antenatal, etc., what is it? You've worked with a lot of them. What do you think keeps them going in spite of Israel's continued, consistent barrage of psychological warfare?
That's a good and important question, and I agree. It is nothing but remarkable and historic, the courage and steadfastness that the Palestinian ambulance paramedics, the doctors, the nurses, the hospital staff at large are showing the world. I used to say again and again, the heroes are in Gaza, and it is the Palestinian healthcare population at large, all professions. They are showing us dignity, morality, and I used to call them the moral compass of these dark weeks and months. They show us that they risk their lives to protect life. They risk their life to protect and serve their people. They don't fly away. They don't shy away. But I have to correct a few misunderstandings and
go ahead,
misconceptions.
Sir. Go on.
Yeah. Number one, and I've discussed this at large with my good colleague and very respected colleague, Dr. Youssef Aboriche, who is the Minister of Health in Gaza. He is the Assistant Minister of Health in the Ramallah government, he's a pediatrician. He's young, he's very powerful. He's been standing tall as a Minister of Health for more than 10 years, a fantastic person. And he says, like I say, we do not perform major surgery without anesthesia.
Okay.
We know the code of ethics, and we are not inflicting large pain on our patients. So with the limited availability of anesthetic drugs, they have to be pretty tough when they do the selection of whom to operate with major surgery. The one case that you talk about, it was not a surgeon, it was an orthoptist, and he was actually tending to the already amputated leg of his daughter at the kitchen table.
Yes.
That's bad enough. The kid should have some kind of pain relief, but he did not amputate the leg, as far as I understand, without anesthesia. That leg was already amputated by Israel without anesthesia.
Wow.
So actually, once you have a blast to your extremity and you have this kind of probably a shrapnel, big shrapnel that cuts off the leg, I myself have been doing those kinds of, it's not an amputation, it's only that you take away the distal part of the already amputated extremity. It may be hanging in some skin, you know, breaches or some tissue breaches, and you just cut it with a scissor. But you don't stand there and do a bone saw to cut it off and somebody holding down that poor patient or that child while screaming. You don't do that. Most of these amputations are already done by the weapon illegally used against civilian people in Gaza. Number two, as for the other major operations, and then we're talking about operation in the chest, opening the chest, or opening the abdomen. You cannot do that on an awake patient for two reasons. Number one, the patient will be breathing, and that is makes it impossible to do major surgery. Number two, the muscles will be very stiff and hardened. Once you try to cut, you cannot open the abdomen. So this is medically impossible. So they do have some means, still too little, because the Israeli army is picking out all the anesthetic drugs from the relief support, I have been told by reliable sources. So then what to do? Well, if you have a patient who needs major surgery, then you may have to find an improvised solution like using ketamine, which is a very good drug for major surgery, and the patient can be breathing him or herself. Or you have to make a mixture or maybe some opioids, some fentanyl, and some thiopentone, for example. This is the anesthesiologist's role, to give the surgeon a good working condition for that patient. Or you actually have to say that this patient will not be operated and will be dying. And that is a very difficult decision, but it needs to be done in situations with what we call mass casualties, which means that there are more casualties coming to your hospital unit or your field hospital than you have resources to handle. Then you have to pick out the ones who have the greatest chance of surviving with the least medical resources used. Because if you start like we would do in my hospital here in Tromsø in Norway, if we had a traffic accident with really bad injuries to the chest and the abdomen, we would take that patient with air ambulance, helicopter to the emergency room. There would be a complete team on neurosurgeon, chest surgeon, vascular surgeon, and we would work on that injured person maybe for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours before we finally said, okay, we lost, he dies. That patient, if you start on that patient in Gaza today, you will occupy that operating room or that table for too long time when the result is likely to be death. And then what you do is actually you deny the other 10 patients waiting in line for a short but life-saving surgical procedure. And this is called triage or prioritizing. And it's a very painful selection process, and it's always done by senior surgeons, and we have to do it. Otherwise, the operating room will be filled with hopeless cases. So in a mass casualty, in a disaster situation, people will die who otherwise might not have died because the capacity is overrun by the number of injured. And imagine Gaza, were you also, in addition to causing, you know, the last number is 62,000 wounded. It's like a deluge, an avalanche of wounded to a hospital system, which they have bombed and destroyed almost completely. So the bed capacity is too little. The operating room capacity is too little. And it's all done on purpose. It's not a natural disaster. It's man-made by Israel, supported by the United States, to make more people die from the injuries, and also, I guess we will talk about that, from disease.
Mm.
Because people don't get healthy from occupation and bombing, I can tell you. So you have all the people with myocardial infarction, with stroke, with diabetes, with renal failure. You have the, what is the last number? It's 60,000 pregnant women in Gaza, as you said, who can have complications like hyperemesis or you know, blood pressure problems. All of these, the deceased population, also do not have healthcare sufficiently. So the tactique of the Israeli occupation army is not only to kill people by bombing them, And I want to pay tribute to the 25,000 killed so far, more than 10,000 children. Yeah. It is not only to wound 62,000 people, but it is deliberately to deny these people healthcare that could have saved their lives. The last report from the United Nations, which is from OCHA, I just received it. This is from the 18th of January, that is yesterday, and it comes every second day. It's called a flash report. Everybody can get it. It comes to my inbox, and it's a one-page infographic from the United Nations. Mm. And this, of course, is from day 103. All the numbers are here. All the numbers. This graph shows the number of wounded day by day. This is the number of killed day by day. And you can see the numbers.
Yes.
Here you see a sum up. 24,620 killed.
Yeah.
61,000 and more wounded. 1.7 million displaced. And they also report. They also report that 15 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals are partially functioning only. 9 in the south and 6 in the north. So more than half of the hospitals in Gaza for 2.2 million good Palestinian people, civilians, are closed down due to lack of fuel, water, electricity, medical supplies, and safety. And at the time, at the same time, as I said, 62,000 wounded and the deceased population to be handled in the remaining half of the hospitals. And the primary healthcare system, they have destroyed, I think it's 54 primary healthcare stations. So this is an unprecedented, brutal, and sadistic attack on civilian people's right to health, right to safety, and the right to have that sacred space of mercy, compassion, and solidarity that our hospitals and our healthcare system is meant to be. It's a crime beyond comprehension, in my opinion.
Indeed it is. When you talk about medicine, obviously one has to go to school, right? Education becomes critical. Israel is touted, and I have to use the word touted, as the only democracy in the Middle East. Yet yesterday, we saw Israel destroy the last university in Palestine, in Gaza, the University of Palestine. In addition to that, the same Israel has gone on and on and on about tunnels being under Al-Shifa Hospital, etc., etc. And you were one of the ones that was saying, I've worked here all these years. I visit this place. I come here. I have never seen, you know, I've never been aware. And certainly I'm not going to hide it if I am, because that goes against everything I stand for. I remember you saying that very, very clearly. Talk to us about the significance of that, of the destruction of that education, that educational institution, and also Israel's noise, if I may call it that, about Al-Shifa Hospital.
Yeah. Let me just repeat again from this fact sheet from OCHA from yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
They say that there are currently 625,000 students in Gaza with no access to education. And that is, in brackets, 100%. Mm. So there is no access to education now. And they also state, the OCHA UN, 90% of all school buildings have sustained significant damage. So what kind of nation are we talking about, bragging about being the only democracy in the Middle East? And at the same time, they massively attack healthcare. They massively attack education systems, not only primary schools, but universities. And they massively attack the civilian society by bombing the habitat of civilian people. This is not democracy. This is, as had been said by B'Tselem, by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International, this is an apartheid state. And you African people, you know apartheid. Mm. You have felt the brutality of apartheid and the brutality of the liberation wars against apartheid. Don't come and tell me, don't teach me, I used to say to people who disagree with me, don't teach me about you know, the Palestinians should have chosen another path than the armed resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Would have gotten out of nowhere. Don't tell me that Nelson Mandela, who was a militant leader of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, and who was, as you know, much better than me, mm-hmm. in prison for years and years and years. But who said, together with the, you know, among others, Ronnie Kasril, you know, the one of the heroes, yes. from the African struggle, they used, unfortunately, as he said when I just talked to him when I was visiting South Africa a few months ago in December, he said, anti-colonial wars have never been clean. They're dirty. They're bad.
Mm.
But if we don't wage that war, we will never be free. And you could have spoken to the late Samora Michel. You could have spoken to Lumumba. You could have spoken to Nelson Mandela. All of them would say, I'm sorry, you don't convince colonialists by talking nicely to them and showing up some UN charter, because they don't give shit about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I support the armed struggle. Bear in mind, I don't support any attack on civilians.
Mm-hmm.
I don't support any armed faction or parties in Palestine, not Hamas, not Jihad, not Qassam, not PA, not Fatah, not PLO. Along with the Norwegian Solidarity Movement for Palestine, I support the Palestinian people and their right to resist occupation, also with arms, but within the limits of the international law and the Geneva Convention, of course. And I support their right to choose their leaders, just as anybody else have the right to choose leaders. You may dislike them, but you can't start bombing them. Imagine that Canada would start bombing the United States when they elected Donald Trump as president just because they didn't like him.
Yeah.
I mean, Hamas was elected in 2006 by a landslide victory, and they shot it down immediately when they formed a national unity government together with PA and Fatah. It was recognized by Russia and Norway and a few other countries, and then within weeks, the Israelis imposed economical sanctions on the West Bank. They started the siege of Gaza, and Gaza has been under siege for 16 years to strangulate them, to starve them, to impoverish them, and to make sure to tell them that if you resist the occupation, we will starve you, we will thirst you, we will kill you, and we will, you know, just be conquering you. So, back to this question about the educational system.
Mm.
Not only have they destroyed the beautiful universities of Gaza. I've been teaching at Al-Azhar University for 10, 15 years. I teach medical students, emergency medicine.
Mm.
They just had their new faculty of medicine, and they were so proud of it. And it was so beautiful. And the labs and the anatomical, you know, models, the teaching rooms, the AV equipment, the IT setup was beautiful. We could room more than 200 medical students in one class. And they bombed it. And they bombed the Islamic University. And they've been bombing churches and mosques by the hundreds. And they have been bombing the majority of the archaeological heritage places in Gaza. And don't forget that Gaza is one of the oldest cities we have in our civilization, along with Saida, Tyrus, Aleppo, you know, all this pearl of cities along the Mediterranean, which is actually the crossroad between Asia, Europe, Africa, and Arabia. Very important crossroads for the cultural meeting,
mm-hmm.
for the meeting of diversity of religions. Now, the Israelis have not only bombed hospitals and eradicated universities, they have eradicated our history. And that is an important element, because this is the epistemicide. And epistemicide may sound like a different word, difficult word.
I was going to say, what does it mean? Yes.
Yeah. Epistemicide means to eradicate and destroy the history, the story of a people. And the story of a people is language, it's culture, it's dancing, it's your literature, it's your religion, it's your history, it's your historical places, it's your churches or mosques or temples, whatever. And it is everything that connects the people to their own history. So the epistemicide is part of the politics of elimination, which is part of the colonial policy in order to grab the land and kill the people and get rid of the indigenous people who actually owned it. So this is all part of trying to eradicate not only Palestine, not only Gaza, but the Palestinian nation as such. And this has always been the plan of the settler colonial Zionist project.
Yeah.
Always. So it should be no surprise.
Indeed.
The thing is that they are not contained and they're not held accountable. So this impunity over years and years and years is getting us, has gotten us to this disaster that we're in now.
Let's talk about that impunity because we don't have much time left. So last week, we saw the South Africans do what meant all the other countries failed to do. Not only did they take Israel to court, by extension, they stood up to the United States and to the limp and weak and, you know, follow, as we call them in Nigeria, United Kingdom, and literally stuck two fingers up and say, we are going to challenge your actions. What are you expecting from that case? What are you expecting from the ICJ?
I think you're very right in pointing out that just getting that case to the court is a victory. It's a huge victory. And who else than RSA would do that? And I don't know. I met some very, very nice governmental people when I was there in November and lecturing. And I think that the main force, the main energy, both to expel or to send home the Israeli ambassador and for the vote in the RSA parliament to close down the embassy and the decision to forward that case for the International Court of Justice was the popular solidarity support for the Palestinian people. And I say that because I don't want any of your listeners to feel helpless. Because it is so easy to feel helpless. One by one, we see these massive attacks. We see the videos on our social media. We hear about the atrocities, and these numbers are, you know, inconceivable. We can't understand them, but we see the individual stories. And we feel helpless against this utterly brutal and mean superpower supported by the United States being allowed or being let loose day after day, week after week, month after month, more than 100 days of killing. And we feel, I cannot stop it. I don't want to look at it. I feel so desperate. I have lots of friends who are depressed because of the direction that the world is taking. But in that depression, please look for light. And I think RSA is a big light because they have a very, very solid, very, very active solidarity movement. Look for all the demonstrations around the world that have been in the streets. Lots of young people, much more young people demonstrating for Palestine now. Look at the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement. I used to say that if every one of us who support Palestine had a little red LED light on our head, and all these were lit, and we flew up a little bit and looked at the globe from an airplane, it would be a massive red carpet of support. It's only that we are not connected. We're not organized well enough.
Yeah.
Because the majority of the people are in favor of life and liberty and freedom and justice, which is what the Palestinian people at the end of the day are fighting for. And solidarity is a massive weapon. And Samora Michel, he said, solidarity is not an act of charity. It is an act of unity between people fighting on different grounds towards the same goal.
Yeah.
That's solidarity.
Okay. I'm going to take a couple of calls. You need to call very quickly. I've only got 7 minutes or so with Dr. 0700 993 993 993. WhatsApp. Do we have any WhatsApp messages?
Yes, we do. This is Jaja. She's asking, ask your guest why Hamas is operating out of hospitals in Gaza. Hamas knows the rules of engagement in wars, but still goes ahead to build tunnels and operation center on the hospitals.
Okay.
And then...
Is there another one?
Yes, there is.
Please go to the other one. I'll get the gist of that.
Okay. Good day, ma'am. I'm kind of confused. Please, can we get more understanding on this Gaza and Israeli war thing?
That is what we've been doing. Where have you been? Anyway, so one of the questions is, why is Hamas operating in hospitals? This is part of the story.
I'll answer that.
Yeah.
Where is the proof?
Thank you.
This is a propaganda lie. This is one of the many propaganda lies from Israel. Everybody who wanted to see it saw what happened when they were invading Shifa Hospital after strangulating and bombing Shifa and killing staff and patients and refugees. What did they find? Nothing. They put some weapons in some incubators. They put some old uniforms and some Kalashnikovs in there. They never could prove that there was a command center. And as I said, I've been saying that all over for the last 3 months. I worked there since, 15 years. I've never seen it. I would never have worked there if it was a command center. Take the Turkish hospital, which was the only cancer hospital in Gaza. They bombed it without any claims that it was a command center. Mm. What is this proof? I mean, the Palestinian people are decent people. They protect their hospitals.
Thank you.
They know international law. And the perpetrator, the Israeli occupation army, is trying to blame. You know, it's the thief shouting, "Stop the thief!"
Thank you. Let me just answer.
I haven't seen any proof. So, if your listener kindly could provide the proof, I'll be discussing it. But this is a rumor, and it's a false allegation and a lie from the Israeli occupation forces.
Thank you, sir. One second. Hello. Okay. I'm coming to your calls. You need to call back because I think the call dropped. And I'll pick up your call. Do we have anything else anymore?
This is coming from Ibrahim from Bagada. He says, my question is, why is Israel...
All that thought.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, good evening, madam.
Good evening. Go ahead with your question, please. Question. You have 30 seconds.
My question is that the NATO, the United Nations...
NATO, yes.
NATO. So nobody, none of this group can put a stop to what this guy is doing.
Okay, thank you. That question was about NATO. Why isn't NATO putting a stop to what Israel is doing? One second, the line. I need you to write that down. I'm going to pick up a couple more calls because the lines are alive now. Hello? Okay. Hello?
Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening. Go ahead with your question very quickly.
Okay. My question, from what he has been saying so far, Mrs. Obori.
Go ahead.
From what he has been saying so far, Dr. Abi is a doctor, right?
Yeah, doctor. Dr. Gilbert. Please,
how do you cope with your own mental health?
Okay.
Having to pass through all this thing, and how do you also carry the people around you along so that you guys will be stable to be able to handle what is on ground?
Okay, excellent question. Thank you. That other question is, how do you cope with your mental health, having been part of this for so long, how do you help other people to carry on? I'm answering the very last call because we have 3 minutes left. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, quickly, your question.
Yeah, my question is, my name is Salami from Magodu. Please, why do they draw the first blood, the Palestinians? They draw
He's a doctor, he's not a politician. Right, go ahead, sir, answer those questions. He said, he said, why did they draw the first blood? And like I said, you're a doctor, not a politician. That was a political question.
Why
did Hamas drop the first blood?
The first blood.
Well, he meant that. Why did Hamas attack on the 7th of October? That was Nigerianism.
Great. Let me take that last question. Thank you for that. This did not start on the 7th of October. This started in 1948 with the Nakba and the in my opinion, unlawful division of Palestine. And the United Nations and the winners of the Second World War giving away half of Palestine to the new Israeli state. That's when it started. And then that's been, a struggle, a continuous struggle for 48 years. A struggle of anti-colonial liberation As I said, in 81, 82, it was PLO and Fatah who were the terrorists. It's so easy to label somebody who resists injustice and occupation for being a terrorist. Nelson Mandela was a terrorist until I think he was 90 on the list of terrorists from the U.S. So one man's liberator is the other man's terrorist. That's too easy an explanation. I consider, as I said, I support the Palestinians' right to resist colonial occupation. The settler colonial project is illegal, it is inhuman, it is brutal, and it's been going on for tenth and tenth of years. And they have the right to resist within the international laws and the humanitarian laws. But they have the right, according to international law, to resist occupation with arms. How do I cope? Well, I thank you for that gentle and caring question. I cope because it is meaningful. I cope because I have a feeling that what all of us are fighting for is a better world. I cope because I have good friends. I have my family, my two daughters, and my colleagues who support me. I cope because I have a social network. I cope because I have water in my shower, I have food in the fridge, I have my passport, which takes me anywhere, and because I can walk freely to my job without being arrested, bombed, or intimidated by any occupation army. I live an easy life, and I can take emotional pain, and I use that pain to be more powerful in my solidarity work. NATO, why doesn't NATO intervene? Good question. Well, NATO is, you know, who is leading NATO? It's the United States. What is the politics of the United States? It's to support Israel. They've been doing that all through these 103 days. They've been flying in these one-ton bombs, you know, by the hundreds and thousands. They have been having the back of the Israeli brutal attack all the way. And why would they then command NATO to stop this? And the Secretary General in NATO is unfortunately Norwegian, Mr. Stoltenberg. He hasn't uttered anything about stopping them. On the contrary, NATO has this double moral by supporting the Ukrainian people's rightful struggle against the Russian occupation. Then there is sanction, then there is boycott and blockade and all types of peaceful political tools applied to control the occupier, Russia, and tons of weapons and money. But when it comes to Palestine, then suddenly there is support for the occupier. This is not a difficult conflict. This is a difficult occupation. And the occupation of Palestine is illegal, according to international law, and it's been going on for far too many tenth of years. So people, stand up for the Palestinian people. Kuluna Gaza, we are all Gaza. This is an attack. Through what we have discussed now, the attack on schools, on hospitals, on healthcare, on pregnant, on children, 10,000 children killed. What kind of world do we want? What kind of future do we want for our children? Do we want a world where might defines right? Or do we want a world where human rights define right and where we want humans to be humans and protected even if we disagree and have a struggle? That's what this is all about. And that's why we all need to engage in solidarity work for the Palestinian people, because they are right to resist racism, apartheid and colonialism.
Can I answer a couple more calls, sir? Would you mind, doctor? Is that okay?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Hello? Hello?
How are you?
Good afternoon. What's your name? Where are you calling from? And please ask your question.
My name is Sam.